Coming up on Weekend America.
Discrimination has a way of pounding down the soul.
You get to a certain point in your life, especially when you're not feeling good about yourself, and when your health is bad, where you just say, hey, I'm tired, and you don't care.
This weekend, spirits are up in a Michigan town that's righting a 40-year-old wrong. I'm Desiree Cooper.
And I'm Bill Radke. If you were to set the world to music, what would it sound like?
And then as we enter into Canada, you hear these nice flourishes of piano, very strong and bold.
This Earth Day weekend, an artist who likes to make the whole world sing. And later, remember those tough financial decisions in college?
If you eat popcorn and lots of it, you get your protein. And then you could spend the money that you would have spent on actual food by going to the record store.
Filling up on vinyl, coming up after the news.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
From American Public Media, welcome to The Weekend. I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul.
I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. You might not be observing Passover this weekend, but you probably can relate to a question it contains. Later this hour, we'll ask ourselves, when is enough enough? It's also International Record Store Day this weekend. Stay with us and pay tribute to the old listening booth. So, besides listening to our show, what are you doing this weekend?
Gardening, probably. Soccer games and gardening.
I can tell you what I'm doing this weekend, and that's flying to Japan.
I live on a horse farm. I'm going to ride my horses and clean up the yard for my parents.
I'm going to the Bel Air Hotel. I have some friends in from New York.
I'll probably be moving with some of my baggage to Manhattan, because I'm moving to a building that has an elevator.
And then Sunday, I'm putting together some invitations for my wedding coming up in July.
On Sunday, it's actually my boyfriend's birthday, so we're going to Palm Springs Sunday night.
I'm going to be 21, so it's going to be pretty cool.
I love that young man who's cleaning the yard for his parents. Note to my kids, get on the Clue boat.
Those voices came from Los Angeles, Brooklyn, and Iowa City.
This weekend, 62-year-old Charnita Mundy is going to be doing what she's done almost every day of her life. Hang out with her little sister, 61-year-old Helen Hatcher.
Hey, sis. Yeah, I am. All 300-some pounds of me.
Charnita and Helen live in Hamtramck, Michigan. That's a 2-square-mile independent town inside of the city of Detroit. The two are happy there now, but it hasn't always been that great. They left the segregated South as teenagers, only to face discrimination again when they moved north to Hamtramck. The city's Jim Crow policies almost pulled them apart forever.
My name is Charnita Mundy, and I grew up in Bessemer, Alabama. I had an average childhood, but my mother, my real mother, died when I was very young. She left with 6 of us.
Charnita and Helen were the only 2 girls.
We was always together, me and Helen. She was quiet, and I wasn't.
After high school, they went to live with relatives in Detroit, Motown, 1965.
It was new, exciting. Going places, doing things, freedom, you know. You know, when you're 18 and you leave home, you be, wow.
They worked, freedom. Married, raised families. The whole time, they either shared the same house or neighboring apartments. In the late 1960s, Charnita decided to buy them a bigger house. That's when they moved to Hamtramck in a 2-family flat.
I lived downstairs and she lived upstairs. When she was going to work and everything, I would keep her kids. We would, you know, keep each other kids and look out for each other. We was always there, you know, cooking and everything. And it was always Helen and Charnita, Charnita and Helen.
They felt at home in their mostly black enclave in the predominantly Polish town. Their neighborhood was separated from the rest of Hamtramck by a freeway. It was both a physical and psychological barrier that Charnita was uncomfortable crossing.
You lived on this side of town, other people's on this side of town. And if you crossed the line, you know, it wasn't pleasant.
Often white business owners refused to serve them. Cabs wouldn't pick them up. In 1968, a class action lawsuit was filed against the city, alleging that Hamtramck was trying to get rid of its black residents. Turns out the highway that ran through Hamtramck was originally planned to go around the town. But Hamtramck city officials intervened and requested that the freeway be rerouted straight through one of its black neighborhoods. After that, the area was destroyed through neglect.
That neighborhood was simply allowed to deteriorate to the point of collapse. So that, for example, the sewer system wasn't working very well. The streets were completely ruined. Houses were being condemned.
That's Michael Barnhart. He was 27 when he became involved in the case called Garrett versus City of Hamtramck. A federal judge looked at the city's urban renewal plan and called it Negro removal. He found that the city was guilty of displacing countless black families. Charnita and Helen's neighborhood was hit hard. Their house was condemned, and they were forced out of Hamtramck. Charnita ended up on the west side of Detroit, Helen on the east side. Up until that point, Charnita had tolerated racism, but now it had broken her apart from her sister. That hit close to home.
When I left Hamtramck, I felt the experience of it. You don't fully understand racism unless it encouraged it happen to you. You know, someone have to treat you different because of the color of your skin, which it shouldn't be.
The judge ordered that new housing be built for the plaintiffs. That was in 1971. For the next 35-plus years, nothing happened. Michael Barnhart again.
Well, that's the first question people ask me is, how could this take 40 years? Part of it is that for years, the city simply fought every issue. Everything was a fight. On top of that, the city was in and out of receivership, and they didn't have the financial resources to do it.
As the years turned to decades, Michael worried that many of his plaintiffs wouldn't live to see justice served. Time was taking a toll on Helen and Charnita, too.
We have the same issues. She has a bad heart. I have a bad heart. Rheumatoid arthritis, she do, too.
And you both are in wheelchairs.
Yes. Yes, we are.
So did that make it harder to see each other?
Oh, in our later years, yes. It made it very hard. And I was on the west side. And she was stuck in the house, and I was stuck in the house. And we couldn't see each other. All we had was the phone.
Then, about 9 years ago, things started to change in Hamtramck. New people were in office. There was more cooperation between local, state, and federal agencies to support the project. Karen Majewski is the current mayor. She's committed to getting the 200 court-ordered houses built.
We can't hold ourselves as a model of inclusiveness and ethnic diversity unless we make sure that we live it. And we can't do that with a 40-year-old racial discrimination lawsuit hanging over us. We have to do right by this thing.
Building the houses was one thing, but finding the original plaintiffs nearly 40 years later, that was another. The lawyers found Helen, but Charnita, she was harder to pin down.
I got a phone from my goddaughter said, Miss Bunny, you know your name in the paper? She asked her, what for? I didn't did anything. My name in the paper? I looked in the paper and I saw it. Helen's name in there, had a lot of people's name in there. And they was telling how to get in touch with people. They was talking about some houses and I didn't call.
You heard about the lawsuit. Mm-hmm. You knew it was discrimination. Why wouldn't you call to make things right?
Because you get to a certain point in your life, especially when you're not feeling good about yourself and when your health is bad, where you just say, hey, I'm tired, and you don't care. You get to a point like that in life sometime.
Juanita Jones is the project manager who was hired to find the plaintiffs or their descendants. Once she found Charnita, she wouldn't let her go. She even made home visits.
You know, there's just something there that kept saying, call her back and make sure. And it just kind of stayed on my spirit. And I didn't know her from any other plaintiff. I had absolutely no idea she was related to Helen.
How many other plaintiffs have you done this for?
None.
Why is this your problem?
This case started officially in 1968, and I was actually born in 1968. And I was born on the day that Martin Luther King Jr. was assassinated. And I've always felt this special connection to the case, you know, like there's a reason for me being here, and maybe that was it.
It wasn't until Helen actually got a subsidized house in Hamtramck that Charnita dared to believe it could happen for her, too. She had just one request.
If they could just find us a house, a block apart or two blocks apart, where I could roll out into it, we could roll and see each other, you know, I would be happy with that. I think the best part of everything was when they told me that they found a house and it was side by side.
Now the sisters are back together again, next door neighbors in Hamtramck.
And you see her, you see right there? Now, she be sitting there looking at TV. You can see it better. And I be sitting here, and I have my phone. Hey, Helen. And we be waving at each other.
And you're looking in her house?
Yeah.
You are a peeping Tom.
No, I'm not. That's my sister.
Juanita, the attorney Michael Barnhart, and even the mayor of Hamtramck were there when the sisters moved in. For Mayor Majewski, this is the beginning of a new era for Hamtramck.
You know, you don't always get to make restitution to the folks that you wronged. And in this case, we can. And what comes out of it is not, you know, just a shaking hands and saying, okay, you know, I'm sorry we did this, but saying, okay, we shake hands and we keep holding those hands. And the path that we walk on after this is one that we walk together in the city. That's what's so gratifying.
Having this house here now next to your sister, does it make up for what was done to you?
It is heavenly. It is wonderful. Yeah, it makes it up. I feel good about myself. My sister's over there. How can that happen?
Wow, Des, that is a beautiful story. What is Hamtramck like today?
Well, you know, Bill, it's changing so fast. In 1970, it was 90% Polish. It was so Polish that Pope John Paul, who was born in Poland, made a stop there in 1987. But by 2000, it was less than a quarter Polish. And now it's like one of those old-fashioned ethnic communities you think of, like old New York, where immigrants from Bangladesh, Bosnia, the Middle East, they're all squashed in this little city that's only 2 square miles. Mm-hmm. There are 26 different languages spoken in the schools, and almost half of its population now is foreign-born. Well, I want you guys to take some time this weekend to visit Charnita and Helen in their new houses. They can't wait to let you in. Go to our website, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is brought to you in part by Target, giving 5% of its income to the community since 1946. That now adds up to over $3 million every week. And by Clarkson Potter, publishers of The Splendid Tables, How to Eat Supper, the latest cookbook inspired by the radio program for people who love to eat. Available now wherever books are sold.
In the news, a Harry Potter lawsuit slash cry fest, messy divorce meets YouTube, and in the campaign, the pot calls the kettle old. Good news, bad news, or no news next on Weekend America. We'll be right back.
This is Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. The weekend is for judgment. This is the part of the show where we divide the week's events into good news, bad news, and no news. Joining us for the first time is the great documentary filmmaker Albert Maysles. You probably know him best for the 1970 classic Gimme Shelter that captured the disastrously violent Rolling Stones Altamont concert. Albert, welcome.
Thank you.
Also with us, author and columnist Dan Savage. Hello, Dan.
Hey, Bill.
And performance artist turned clothing designer Damali Ayo. Hi, Damali.
Hello.
Our first topic, Democratic Pennsylvania Congressman John Murtha, age 75, said this week that John McCain, age 71, is too old to be president. Did that remark strike you as good news, bad news, or no news?
I'm bad news. I don't like to see anything restricting age. Actually, after this discussion, I'm going off and continuing a project that I'm doing where I'm filming kids ages 3 to 7, just two at a time in conversation with one another. It's about time that we paid attention to the intelligence and odd observations of these kids as they talk to one another. And it's the same thing is at the other end of the line, older people. I don't like to see an age barrier.
Bad news. Damali?
I'm kind of on the no news front about it, although I will recall that I was in second grade when Ronald Reagan was elected, and the only thing that I could really understand about him was that he was really old. And I remember going to school and saying, he's too old to be president. And, you know, as you know, we just learned out of the mouths of babes, because who had Alzheimer's 8 years later?
Yeah.
So I don't want to say, you know, let's discriminate, but I do want us to be aware of the hazards of aging presidents.
I'd like to point out also that when the Founding Fathers wrote the Constitution, they set a limit of 35. So we already discriminate on the basis of age. You can't be too young and be president. And when they set that 35-year-old age, not a lot of people lived past 40 or 50. So there used to sort of be an upper age bracket that was imposed by life expectancy rates, and we currently don't have that. I mean, would we elect a 95-year-old to be president? Would we have elected Bob Hope when he was 99?
But we see John McCain, we listen to him speak, we see his record. Voters can decide whether he's, you know, lucid and competent.
If he flip-flops like a younger man?
Like a man much younger.
By the way, I guess it's relevant that I'm 81 and as active as ever. My skills, I think, are at their best at this time.
And are you single?
Okay, our next topic. Harry Potter author J.K. Rowling filed a copyright infringement lawsuit against a fan who has compiled an encyclopedic Harry Potter lexicon. This week, this mild-mannered librarian faced the author, his idol, in a Manhattan courtroom, and the guy broke down sobbing. Is this whole court fight good news, bad news, or no news?
Bad news, man. That was the saddest story I have ever read.
Why do you say that?
I just felt so bad for this man. Here's his hero. He's obviously obsessed with her writing, obsessed enough to the point of creating this whole encyclopedic lexicon thing. And she's worried that it's going to compete hers out of the market. I mean, it just made her look greedy. And I mean, you have to, her fans made her. So how could she treat one of them so poorly?
I'm sure if he had been approached with some sort of deal that, you know, acknowledged her copyrights and
like her autograph,
the material, and gave her, you know, gave him her autograph and changed some of the material that she had a problem with, it could have all been worked out. It just seems really, you know, flouting a swy with a nuclear device, the way they've gone after him.
My experience with my film Grey Gardens maybe runs some kind of parallel. I was quite happy to see that there were people that wanted to make a musical of Grey Gardens. And then there's a Hollywood film that is just finished in its shooting. I think that we should respect people's reaction to a work of art as well as the work of art itself.
Didn't they have to get the rights from you, though? Didn't you sign something?
Yes. Yes, that's true. That's true.
Okay, our final topic. This week, the New York Times reported on the trend of messy divorces on YouTube. For example, the soon-to-be ex-wife of a New York theater executive has posted a video telling her side of their legal battle and exposing parts of their private life.
I don't know if you know, but you know, Philip and I never had sex, but he's got Viagra and condoms and stuff here and porn movies. Just ask him what he wants me to do with them. Would you?
Wait. You want me to ask him this now?
Yeah, just ask him what he wants me to do with the condoms and the porn movies and the Viagra.
Of course, we have no way of knowing whether she's telling the truth, but now we all know what she's telling. Is this good news, bad news, or no news?
It's good news if it gets the British pronunciation of condom into common usage in the United States. I love condoms. Okay. It sounds so much classier.
Okay, classy was not the word I was expecting, but classy good news. Others?
I thought this one was fantastic. I have to say, as a chronic oversharer, she is my hero. This is fantastic. I don't think it's going to help her case at all, but I love that she just did what probably many, many women in this situation want to do, and I absolutely commend her efforts. I hope she becomes a superstar and doesn't need her pension from her divorce.
The amount of personal laundry that people will air online, I think people don't understand that this will live forever once you put it online. It used to be you could, you know, appear in a little porn and it would disappear after a little while. If you, you know, your parents didn't show up at the particular store selling it, you never had to worry about it. Everything you put out there digitally exists forever and is instantly recallable. It can be called up with a single search. And I don't think people get it. And I certainly don't think this woman gets it. I don't think she understands that that no man will ever be fool enough to marry her ever again.
So what kind of news is this, Dan?
It's bad news for her, and I think it's kind of bad news about us as a species.
At least it's one person talking to a vast number of people. It's a respect for the human individual. And I think that we waste our lives not relating to one another through a medium that could vastly improve itself by injecting poetry and humanity into its content.
Do we need a filmmaker like you interceding to bring someone's story in an enlightening way? There's no one standing between this woman and the YouTube audience. I wonder how, as a documentary filmmaker, you watch something like that.
My mother always used to say, there's good in everybody, so that I think that I would be able to somehow or other capture some more decent moments in this woman's diatribe. And that would give it some balance.
She needed you to help tell her story.
Yes, I think so.
That's the news this week. Panel, thank you so much.
Thank you, Bill.
Thanks.
Thank you. It's an honor.
Albert Maysles has a new book out called A Maysles Scrapbook, Photographs, Cinemagraphs, Documents. Dan Savage writes Savage Love. His weekly podcast is called Savage Lovecast. You can see Damali Ayo's clothing designs. And whether you want to or not, you have the option of watching that YouTube divorce video. And you can tell us what's good, bad, and no news to you this weekend when you come visit us at our home, weekendamerica.org.
Weekend America is supported in part by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. This program is made possible by grants from CPB, the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, with support from public radio stations including WBUR Boston, WCPN Cleveland, and KPCC Los Angeles.
This weekend, Passover is a chance to ask yourself, when is enough enough? That's coming up on Weekend America. Thank you.
I'm Bill Radke in Los Angeles. Welcome to The Weekend.
And in St. Paul, I'm Desiree Cooper. This month, we've been airing your stories about spring. I know, for much of the country, spring is old news. Azaleas have already bloomed in Virginia, and the warblers are nesting in Georgia. But here in Minnesota, we're still waiting for green grass. That's what Corey Befford Patnod learned as a child. She moved with her family here in January. They'd never lived this far north, and they just were not used to the stark winters. Corey remembers that year when springtime started to arrive and the magic unfolded in her yard.
When I was 9 and my sister was 4, we moved with our family to a little town up in northern Minnesota called Grand Rapids. My dad was in a forestry service in the Department of Natural Resources, and so we'd moved a lot through my childhood into northern states, and northern Idaho, northern California. We moved to Minnesota in January when it is absolutely the coldest. That was the very, very first time that we had ever been any place that cold or that far north. I've never experienced cold like that before. It was just like there was nothing happening in the landscape. It seemed so dead, and we were just inside, and my sister and I are homeschooled, so we were in the house in this big, drafty, huge picture windows, and it was just so cold because we hadn't figured out how to heat it very well yet. So we were just bundled up, and we'd be in the corner doing schoolwork next to the floor heaters, just trying to stay warm, kind of camping out, burrowed in to the corner, trying to be happy about where we'd moved to, but feeling really uncertain and kind of nervous about having moved there. So my mom had sort of determined that we'd had the last real frost. There was still snow in places, but it wasn't gonna, you know, it was pretty much starting to melt off. And we were able to start to figure out that some of the little mounds in our yard, which had just looked like mounds of snow, were actually maybe flower beds. And when we started pulling all these dead leaves off the flower bed, underneath were these amazingly green shoots and spikes, like so strong that when you ran your hand over the top of them, they would prick and flick your hands, just so robust. And we could just tell that this garden was just full of flowers, just cheek by jowl. And that day was so special because we just had no sense of belonging at that house, and yet somehow the act of discovery made us feel like we belonged, like we were welcomed somehow by something inviting us to belong there too. Now that I'm a Navy wife and I'm frequently placed in new locations and new situations, and seemingly our moves always land us someplace at around February or January. It's just the way it's worked out. So I try to keep in mind that spring that I had with my family when we were uncovering the flower beds, and remind myself that actually maybe January and February are the best times to move, because they really hold the most mystery and also the most sort of immediate payback for that mystery. You get there and you're a little disappointed, but you know that so soon things are going to start coming out and revealing themselves to you, and you're going to be welcomed by those things.
Corey Befford Patnod lives in Seattle, or in the Seattle area, actually, and her family still lives in that home with that beautiful garden in Minnesota. Corey's a professional dancer, and this is her heavy rehearsal time, but she says spring gives her so much energy that she's actually going to go dancing with her friends this weekend after her dance rehearsals. And she's also hoping for a phone call from her husband, who's currently on the USS Nimitz.
We'll be right back.
Weekend America's founding sponsor is Target.
Welcome back to Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper. This weekend, Jewish families the world over gather to remember the story of the Jewish exodus from Egypt. The Passover Seder is a special event steeped in symbolism. The assembled group reads from a Haggadah, retelling the story of Exodus. Certain symbolic foods are eaten. These traditions go back thousands of years. This year, Judith Sloan in Queens, New York, will pull down the Haggadah her father left her and sing the song Dayenu, which translated means enough. This Passover, Judith is considering that word. She's thinking about hardship and war and torture and whether we've had enough. She's thinking about food and water and natural resources and wondering if we'll ever have enough. Judith brings us this audio essay titled Enough, Enough, Dayenu, Enough.
Each year at Passover, I think about, argue about, dream about, and question this question of Dayenu, enough. Dayenu. I take down the silver-plated Haggadah given to me by my father when I was a little girl. This Haggadah, one of the few things I have left of him. I inherited the questioning, the dark eyes, dark hair, dark moods. I look through this Haggadah, a marriage of text and image, the pages designed like the pages of the Talmud, taken from the Talmud, multiple arguments on two-page spreads in four colors. I look at Dayenu, Dayenu, Dayenu. What does it mean? Enough. In this time, in the Middle East, in this time, in the USA. Dayenu, 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 die, die, die. Hey, 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 new, 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 new. In Deuteronomy, it says, with an outstretched arm, with a mighty hand, with great terribleness, this means the manifestation of the divine presence. God sent his wrath, indignation, trouble, sending evil angels, 10 plagues. God took him a nation from the midst of another nation, by temptations, by signs, and by wonders, by war, by a mighty hand, with an outstretched arm, and by great terrors. According to all that, the Lord your God did that for you in Egypt.
God did that for me in Egypt?
I read that over and over as a little girl.
God did that for me?
Each year wondering what would have been enough. Why boils? Why locusts? You don't hear about locusts these days. Why blood? Why frogs? Why wild beasts? Couldn't it have been enough to part the sea? Why did God have to slay the firstborn of every Egyptian? I thought that was the die in Dayenu.
God did that for me in Egypt? God did that for me?
Wouldn't it have been enough to just go after the Pharaoh? To be free from slavery, from enslaving? Would that be enough? What is enough? When is it enough? Who is it enough for? Enough land, enough water, enough work, enough recognition, enough joy, enough love, enough pleasure, pain, enough of my own delusions. When is it enough? And each year at the Passover table, I promise myself that I won't eat too much.
Young lady,
young lady,
don't you think,
don't
you've,
you
had
think
enough?
You've had enough? Is there enough to go around? Is my freedom dependent on your loss? The argument erupts every year at the Seder. An 80-year-old is criticizing the state of Israel. Israel should stop dehumanizing the Palestinians. A 60-year-old is defending Israel. What about Hamas? They'll stop at nothing. They call for the murder of Jews everywhere. The 20-year-old agrees with the 80-year-old. It's Israel's responsibility, too. The 40-year-old is trying to negotiate at the table. The 60-year-old cannot see the Palestinians as human. They are the enemy. But who is going to stop the path of mutual homicide? Suicide. I studied with a rabbi once who said, to see your enemy as human is a truly painful thing. You hate them, they hate you, how can you look them in the eye? If I come to you my enemy with an outstretched arm. Will you blow it off? Isn't all life sacred? Dianu, Dianu, Dianu. Why not with an outstretched arm, with a great joy, with compassion, with wonders? Could God do this for us? Why not a miracle now? Where is the miracle now? I want a miracle now. If only we could beat our swords into plowshares and share it, all of it. This planet, in this lifetime, this land, this country, this money, this city, this neighborhood, this moment. With an outstretched arm, with a bold heart, with wonders, with joy, who can do this? Can we do this? And will it be enough?
Judith Sloan lives in Queens, New York. The original music was performed and composed by Frank London, recording engineer Taylor Rivelli. And special thanks to our friends at the public radio website, hearingvoices.com.
I'm Desiree Cooper in St. Paul, along with Bill, who's in Los Angeles. Take a listen to this. That is the sound of the Middle East. And this is the sound of Austin, Texas. This weekend before Earth Day, we thought we'd share this next piece with you. It's about the sound of the earth, at least how it sounds to one visual artist named James Plakovic. He's the man behind a fascinating work of art called World Beat Music. Weekend America's Chrissy Clark spoke with him about it.
Picture your basic map, Mercator projection, like the one from social studies class. America's right in the middle, flanked by Africa and Europe on the right, and China and Australia to the left. Central Asia's divided at the far ends, half on one side of the map, half on the other. You know what I'm talking about. Now, look a little closer. You realize on this map, the continents are actually made of tiny dots, like a George Seurat painting. Get even closer, and you realize those dots are actually musical notes.
Every land mass there is has been transformed into musical notation. A note, a rest, so that the end result, when you step back from the image itself, you see a part of the world.
James Plakovic spent a month and a half hand-drawing this world map slash musical score. He carefully arranged each note so that together they'd look like a map of the Earth. He replaced latitude lines with staff lines and divided them up for an orchestra of 37 instruments. Each instrument simultaneously follows a horizontal cross-section of the map from west to east. Staff lines for woodwinds run across the map near the North Pole. Lots of notes along the coastlines of Greenland. Long rests across the Arctic Sea. Further down, there are parts for pianos through the U.S. and Europe and Central Asia. The brass section covers the equator. And from the Tropic of Capricorn down to the South Pole, those are the notes for the string section. No orchestra has ever been crazy enough to actually play this map, but recently James used a computer program to turn the score into music. He started with just a few of the instrument parts. Here it is with flute, two pianos, two violins, and a cello. Listen.
We start over in the middle of Asia. The string section is very sweeping and very beautiful across this particular part of the world. And then as we enter into Canada, you hear these nice flourishes of piano, very strong and bold. Antarctica stretches all along the bottom, and you have these two little cellos. The piece kind of settles down a little bit as you sail across the ocean. Africa and Western Europe, you get, again, some flourishes of piano. And then the piece just very nicely comes to an end where it started.
Of course, the world is round, so the piece should actually loop endlessly. And each time you hear the piece, you pick out a new detail.
Even the Hawaiian Islands, as small as they may be, makes it in as 5/16 notes. C, EEDD.
There are moments that are beautiful if heard in isolation on this musical map of the Earth. But when you hear all 37 instruments together playing every note on the map, things get cacophonous, to say the least. The notes that make up Central America have no relationship to the notes above them in Michigan. The Middle East clashes with Madagascar below it.
There are some spots that are flowing and harmonious, and there are definitely some areas that are a little bit brash and discordant, and it reflects how the world is.
Did you ever try to make a particular area more harmonious? You know, if I just made that a fifth rather than a fourth, the world would be a better place.
If only it was that easy.
Balanced between two 16th notes in California, I'm Chrissy Clark for Weekend America.
Special thanks to Professor Jonathan Berger at Stanford University for help translating the musical map of the Earth from an image to actual sounds.
In Washington, D.C. tomorrow, American Idol Jordan Sparks will sing for Earth Day as rain falls to the earth. Now here's our John Moe with his look at weekend weather.
From our Let's Hope for the Best file, an event in Wimberley, Texas. 85 degrees and clear skies for the Butterfly Festival featuring music, charity auction, and butterflies, plus Air Force flyover. So, delicate little butterflies and massive jet aircraft in the sky at the same time. Depending on the altitudes chosen, it will either be pastoral or gruesomely spectacular. The Summer Olympics will have athletes from all over the world, massive spectacle, controversy, of course, but they won't have a 26-mile rubber chicken relay race, not like Gainesville, Georgia. Thunder in 68 at the Spring Chicken Festival. The rubber chicken fencing event never worked out. And rubber chicken pole vault, you don't want to know. Hockey hair, helmet hair, the Kentucky waterfall, the mullet hairdo has many names. Orange Beach, Alabama adds one more, racing champion. Partly cloudy, 74 degrees at the 12th annual Mullet Man Triathlon. Does the long hair in the back slow you down? Racers must swim, bike, and run, but are not allowed to travel via REO Speedwagon. For information on these and other events, go to weekendamerica.org. With a little bit of weather everywhere, I'm John Moe for Weekend America.
Coming up, you walked in, you browsed, you thumbed, you listened, paying tribute to the record store next on Weekend America. I'm Bill Radke with Desiree Cooper, and this is the radio show about this weekend. Yes, this is a weekend of Earth Day events and Passover Seders, but let's not forget that this is also, significantly, Record Store Day. Independent record stores all over the world are celebrating.
Yep, and so are we. Last week, we asked you for your record store memories, and a lot of you paid tribute to the listening booth. Remember when you could walk into a record store, choose a record, and preview it in a private booth?
Well, let's bring back those days. We're going to close the door, put on the record, and listen to your record store memories. This first story is from listener Pam Hildebrand.
The Beatles had absolutely opened my head to everything, absolutely everything. The summer before my freshman year in Chapel Hill, which would have been 1970, we had to go down for a weekend probably for freshman orientation. I found the record bar. It was an entire store that was there solely for the music. And it was pretty much like Nirvana, I would say. Well, she looked at me, and I could see that before too long, I'd fall in love with her. The first time I went in, the album that I actually bought was Joni Mitchell's Ladies of the Canyon. She did not have the impact on me that the Beatles had, because that was quite nearly instantaneous. But it was a very quick movement in hearing what she did with her voice, with her lyrics. And she has remained to this day my absolutely favorite female artist. Don't it always seem to go that you don't know what you've got till it's gone? They paid paradise, put up a parking lot. When I was in school, I was your quintessential poor college student. One of the things I learned was that if you eat popcorn and lots of it, you get your protein, and then you could spend the money that you would have spent on actual food by going to the record store. And I ate a lot of popcorn. Farmer, put away the DDT now. Give me spots on my apples, or leave me the birds and the bees. Please.
My name is Ted Quinn. I live in Joshua Tree, California. And Record Paradise was a tiny little mom-and-pop store on Hollywood Boulevard where they sold 8x10 glossy photos of all my favorite rock stars like the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. I was overwhelmed by the stacks of pictures and records that went to the ceiling, but there was a boy a couple years older than me. His name was Johnny, I found out later. Johnny had hair down past his waist, and he was wearing very cool bell bottoms and boots and probably a t-shirt that said The Who. Said, "Psst, hey kid, come here." And he showed me the aisle of records in the back of the store where all the records looked the same. They all had plain white covers with the name of the artist just stamped on the front. So it would say something like Trademark of Quality, The Beatles, Get Back. And these were something called bootleg records. One of the records that was out as a bootleg long before it was officially released is the famous Bob Dylan and the band Basement Tapes.
Well, I've already had two beers. I'm ready for the broom. Please, Mrs. Henry, won't you take me to my room?
A lot of his fans already had that record years before it was officially released. And I remember reading Bob Dylan saying that he was surprised that the record did so well because he thought everybody already had it. I'm down on my knees and I ain't gotta die.
My name is Matt Vaughn. I'm the owner of Easy Street Records here in Seattle. At my original store, I do recall getting a phone call about 11 o'clock at night from a friend of mine that was working with the Beastie Boys, and he had my number and said, "Hey, Matt, we have a pretty dire situation. We need you to open up your store because Mixmaster Mike from the Beastie Boys and the rest of the guys, that none of their vinyl showed up. And the first show of the tour is tomorrow."
Cause nobody can do it like Mixmaster can.
I opened up the store for him about midnight or so, and they came in and loaded up and used those records for the Hell of Nasty tour. The Hell of Nasty record was coming out that very next day, and we did have a few customers that thought we were still open or were having a midnight sale or something. And a few of them came in, or I let them in, and they bought Hello Nasty and bought it right from Mad Rock. 300, 400 people have told me that they bought their record from Mad Rock that night, but we only sold three records.
Record Store Day is spinning across the country as we speak at Rasputin Music in Mountain View, California. Metallica is appearing today. Awesome. Björk is releasing her new single today, although not on vinyl. Instead, participating record stores are handing out 3D glasses so you can watch Björk's video on their in-store kiosks. Well, times do change.
Yes, they do. And Tom Waits has written this tribute to independent record stores. Folks who work here are professors. Don't replace all the knowers with guessers. Keep them open. They're the ears of the town. And if you go to our website, you can read other memories about record stores. Check out the B-side. It's all at weekinamerica.org.
Well, that's it for another hour of American Public Media's Weekend America, produced by Ben Adair, Julia Barton, Jim Gates, Millie Jefferson, E. Okobe, Philip Stearns, Sam Keenan, Michael Rayfield, Tim Bomba, and Angela Kim, who's taking her mom to the Mall of America this weekend.
Also, Rob Byers, Susie Lechtenberg, Chrissy Clark, who's meeting her friend's newborn Simon for the first time this weekend, Brendan Noonan, Michael May, David Banks, who's enjoying his vintage Schwinn kickback bike this weekend, Phyllis Owens, John Moe, and Mark Sanchez.
Galactic created our theme music. Executive producers Peter Clowney, Jim Russell created the show. I'm Bill Radke.
And I'm Desiree Cooper. For those who celebrate it, happy Passover. Enjoy the weekend.
This program is made possible with support from AIR, the Association of Independents in Radio, and public radio stations including WMFE Orlando, KUOW Seattle, and KNOW St. Paul, and made possible by grants from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Weekend America is produced and distributed by
American Public Media.
Hi, I'm Bill Radke, host of Weekend America. The weekends are for exploring.
I've really enjoyed Georgia. It's been extremely rural, very friendly.
With the 10 dogs that are running toward us right now.
That really is. Let's cross the street.
It was really scary because I thought they were going to capsize our boat. When you got fish attacking you, that's wrong.
Becoming one with nature, plus a whole lot more. It's Weekend America every Saturday. Join us.